Welcome to the Reformist Pipeline, your dose of empowerment and pipeline to inform your decisions on how you can support change in the education system. I'm Heidi, tagline still pending, but feel free to shoot me recommendations.
My name is Lindsay, affectionately known as Miss Black. Since we are a new and budding podcast, we still want to be able to lay out on the table exactly what you can expect to hear from us. This week, we are going to go through all three of our rotating segments.
Our first segment is called Terminology Time. In this segment, we'll define a word or a phrase that is commonly used in education. The purpose is to give our listeners the opportunity to understand these words and phrases, and more importantly, understand educator talk. When we all understand the language, we all will be able to create meaningful change. Our first term is metacognition. I'll say that one more time, a little slower. Metacognition. Metacognition is the process used to plan, to monitor, and assess your understanding and performance. Just to give you an example, when a teacher is teaching a new concept, we often will ask students questions about the concept. We ask these questions to encourage students to reflect in the moment on what they are learning. The end goal is to get students to critically think and use those self-regulation skills not only while they are learning, but in life. One metacognitive strategy is called a think aloud. This is normally used when you are teaching some type of reading comprehension or problem-solving strategy. The teacher will literally ask questions or mention different things that they are thinking while they are reading. That's our term of the day. Stay tuned to hear more.
This section is entitled Two Sets of Notes, and here's where we got the inspiration. Two Sets of Notes is a poem written by M.K. Asante. Asante explains he always takes one set of notes he can call the truth. And when he does his own research, he finds the historical contradictions, which he then calls his second set. This is similar to how we're taught about American history through a Eurocentric lens, basically all of our schooling, until we get to an HBCU or we do our own research or we seek out these spaces that will provide us with the Black experience and Black history. So this part is where we'll highlight something current and provide our second set of notes with a teacher lens. So we are all, just incredibly shocked across the nation, across the entire world of the death of Kobe Bryant and his daughter and the seven others that were on the helicopter. I think it really tugged at a lot of our hearts in a different way. And I was exceptionally hurt just thinking about all the people that he impacted. And so I actually brought this story to my classroom and we had a morning meeting about it because I've never had or I haven't had the opportunity and the maturity to be able to go through with it, a conversation about grief and loss with kids. So we watched the video. They got to be able to express their feelings, express their thoughts. And I just sat there silently and listened, even though I had opinions to what their thoughts were, but I didn't want to take away their thoughts and kind of manage their grieving process. But I did end off with one note and I asked them, I was like, raise your hand if you remember at the beginning of the year when I was really getting on y'all about walking through that door and saying good morning. Now, for some reason, kids these days are not raised to speak when they walk into a room. That really bothers me, deeply. So I always force them to say good morning to me. And now it's become a practice. And now we can recognize that it brings more positivity to the classroom. But the first couple of months, I really had to beat them in with that because like, that's just not how my classroom is ran. And so now they're very used to it and they raise their hand. They're like, yeah. And they're laughing. Cause you know, I'd be going ballistic when they don't speak. So then I'd switch gears. I said, well, raise your hand if you were close and knew Kobe Bryant personally. Of course, nobody raised their hand. So then I was like, okay, raise your hand if you know somebody who knew him personally. And naturally, no one raised their hand. I told them, you don't know him personally. Nobody in this classroom, nobody in this school, probably super limited people in DC and like even more limited people across the nation, internationally. There's not a lot of people that can say they really knew him on a personal level. And then I asked them to try and guess the amount of people he impacted. Of course, the number is very, very great. And so I tried to relate it to the fact that, like, Kobe Bryant wasn't close to all these people that are grieving his loss. Kobe Bryant had an impact on people across the world, whether it's because of his basketball, whether it's because people hated the Lakers or hated the Shaq and Kobe duo, or maybe it's because people have daughters, or maybe it's because people are Black men. He impacted those people. And he carried this energy with him that impacted those people. And so I just flipped it on him a little bit. And I told him, like, don't you ever think that because you're an individual that you can't impact anybody. And don't think that your energy isn't carried with you in every space you decide to take up, which is why I'm always on him about bringing positive energy into the space, because you can make an impact like a Kobe Bryant.
All right, so this next section is called We Love the Kids. And this section is where we'll reflect on how an experience with a child has moved us. And so in my second year of teaching, I had a student who at first really struggled behaviorally and academically as well. And it wasn't until I reached out to his parents that I was told that he's been at a different school every year since kindergarten. And so this really put me into a deep space of reflection, just thinking about the fact that he was a fourth grader. And from kindergarten until now, that he had been in a different school every single year. Not to be dramatic, but literally kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, and now fourth. So 5 years, five different schools. So that meant to him that literally every year he had to learn not only just a new school, but a new teacher and make new friends every single year, in addition to trying to take on the task of learning. And I think that sometimes we don't really think about what that truly means for a student or what that truly means for a child. And when you put a child into a different environment, that's already one thing. But if you are consistently changing that environment, consistently changing the rules that the child has to listen to, and I think that that's what we truly don't think about what new schools mean for students. And so it took a while for my relationship to grow with him. And by a while, I mean nearly 6 months. So literally, I spent the first half of the year developing a relationship with him so that it could truly turn into a space of in which he trusted me, because I knew that there wasn't going to be any type of learning until he trusted me. And so, of course, we would have on the off chance here and there that he'd be able to learn a couple of letters, a couple of words here and there. And mind you, might add that he definitely was reading below his grade level. He came in at a second grade reading level. And at the end of the year, we got him on a third grade reading level. And no, that wasn't on grade level. But the thing is what's most important to highlight is the fact that he did grow. And the only reason why he did grow is because he was able to trust me. And literally one of the biggest conversations that I had with his parents was, I need you to give me another year. I need you to literally trust us and please bring your child back. And unfortunately, he did have to change schools one more time. But the reasoning behind it was a little different. And I think that the school placement that we ended up deciding on would be best for him. Just the fact that I know that he was able to trust me is what I truly was so proud about. But more importantly, how invested he became in his education when he knew that I cared about him and that we had a relationship that was so meaningful to him. And it took time out of my planning. But the thing is that at the end of the day, the child knew that he can trust me. And that was the reason as to why he was so motivated to learn, is because he felt like someone was investing in him. And that wasn't always the experience that he received at other schools. And so speaking to that experience truly taught me that regardless of what your timeline is as an educator. I think it's very easy to go into a classroom and to listen to your administrators and hear about how your students need to be performing and the traditional rate of performance. And it can be very overwhelming for you to hear all of these expectations and for you to feel as if you're not living up to them. But I think that you have to realize that that student is not going to perform until they feel like they can trust you. And until that student feels like they can trust you, that's what's going to make their learning experience so much easier. It wasn't until then that he was able to really put his best foot forward and really know that at the end of the day, this is a relationship that we have with one another. At the end of the day, you know that I am here for you. And just like I'm here for you, I want you to be here for me. And until we find that like happy medium between the both of us, we're not going to be able to get anywhere. So at the end of the year, although he was not reading on grade level, that's not what was most important to me. At the end of the day, I was able to teach this child that you are able to go into a school, enter a new environment, and it's important for you to feel safe. It is important for you to put that trust in an adult so that you can invest in your own education until you feel that you don't need to open up. And I think that it was that aha moment for me that, just like I said earlier, that it's very important as an educator that we don't always go into the classroom with these preconceived notions about expectations that our administrators give us. It's very important for us to literally do our job, which is meeting our students where they are at. And at that point in time, my student was at a space in which he came into a classroom in which he didn't know anyone. He didn't have any friends. He had two siblings that were at the school, but that was it. And so until he was able to build that trust, until we were able to build that trust with one another, we weren't going to get anywhere. So really appreciate that student, really love that student. And that's the reason why we love the kids.
And with that, you can expect to hear one of our three rotating segments on every single episode here on out. And those segments are called Terminology Time, A Set of Two Notes, and We Love the Kids. Now let's take a pause to listen to a message about one of our partners. Cut the noise. Cut the noise, cut the noise. If you're not tuning in to Kicking It with Key, then you are surely missing out. Key is a YouTuber, self-care enthusiast, an educator, hey, a queen of unboxings, and a lupus survivor. And Key is also one of my really good friends. Kicking It with Key focuses on sharing personal journeys to light the pathway for others through tips and hacks for everyday struggles. If you're interested in cutting the noise and living your very best life, tune in every other Sunday at 7 p.m. on YouTube. You can find Key on YouTube at Kian Cole. Let me spell it out for you. K-I-A-N-A-C-O-L-E. You can also find Kicking It with Key on Instagram at Kicking It with Key _. I'm going to spell that out for you too. K-I-C-K-I-N-I-T-W-I-T-H-K-I_. Join Key so you can also live your very best life. All right, so this segment is actually the meat of the episode, and it is entitled Concept Development. So to give you some background, and in any good high-quality standard lesson, there's usually a couple of components. And so to usually start with fluency, which is just review of concepts that students have already learned. And it might even tap into some background knowledge so that students have a foundation to understand what is about to be presented to them. So the concept development is the meat of the lesson. It's the pieces, the steps, or like the building up to the final understanding of the big idea or the final objective. So right now we're in the concept development, and our central question of our concept development today is, what is urban education?
So that is the question. And, you know, like, let's just go ahead and say that one more time. What is urban education? Mm-hmm. All right. So an urban school area is a school with inside an urbanized area in a large city. And that generally has a population between 100K and 250K. Then you have a suburb school, which is a school outside an urban area. And that has a population between 100K and 250K as well. And then lastly, you have your rural school. I really don't like that word, but it's your school that's less than or equal to 5 miles from an urban area.
Bam, we got action. Okay, so we have the definitions. And then so Jihad and I decided to read this article that was posted by The Atlantic. It's called The Urban School Stigma, excuse me. So we'll also put this link inside of the episode description if you would also like to take a read. But I do want to give you a general idea of what the article is about before we go on and talk about our responses and our opinions. So the article right underneath the title states, "The Urban School Stigma, influenced by biases against urban education, parents are moving away from city schools and contributing to segregation in the process." So essentially, the entirety of this article was a comparison of urban schools and suburban schools and talked about the biases and the stereotypes that are built around urban schools. So whether it's like policymakers and politics talking about the low quality of urban schools, or it's media outlets that are regularly running stories about failing urban schools, people are hearing about these things. And like, people, stakeholders of students are hearing about these things, especially parents. And so parents are moving or deciding where they're going to live and raise their children based on test scores. And of course, or that's not necessarily, of course, I do hope this changes, but the data shows that urban schools are more low performing in regards to test scores only in comparison to suburban schools. And so the article goes on to talk about parents moving for those reasons. And we're going to talk about our responses and our opinions.
Right.
So we read this article and we intentionally did not talk to each other about what we thought about the article so that we could give you like an authentic spiel, an authentic conversation and discourse. But there were a couple of times where I had to tell Jihad to shut up because he really wanted to talk about it in that moment. And so I'm actually going to let Jihad go first and talk about some of the points that he would like to make about the article.
Thank you so much, Ms. Black. So, you know, so, and I also wanted to just stamp the fact that this article was written in 2017, and we do know this, and I do think that that's just to goes to show that it still is relevant, and it was written August 25th, 2017 by Jack Schneider. And so, just to dive in, so we got urban education, and I was really in favor of the article at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then it just, right, in theory, exactly. Thank you so much. Because, like, and then it just took a spiral because I genuinely was in favor of what Jack was saying in regards to the fact that, so he, I think I quoted this correctly, but it states that if such departures are driven by good in, for about the school information. So basically speaking to the fact that if folks are leaving because of the data, mm-hmm. then great. And then we keep reading on later on, and then Jack goes into this explanation as to discussing, maybe I'm jumping ahead of myself, but I also want to point out the fact that he stated something to the, he said a recent New York Times feature produced something about charts and perspective about suburban home buyers and using only those home inputs. Now, I want to know what you thought about that, because I think that that stuck out to me. And if we could just...
What I thought about people like using buying homes based on school data.
Exactly.
You really want to know what I thought, or you want to say what you want to say? Because that's not what it's looking like right now. But I can tell you.
Yes, please.
Okay.
tell me what you think.
I am not a home buyer, but
right.
I can't say I'm totally angry with that,
mm-hmm.
because I just hear that from like my elders or older people that I know, and when they're deciding to like my coach from. I played club basketball at Howard. My coach moved to Alabama, and he was talking about how, you know, he just had a child. He was talking about how he is not going to, doesn't want to raise his child in Alabama. He's like, you know, when we decide to up and leave, I'm going to be looking at places with good schools.
Hmm.
And, you know, where education is and how important that is right now in terms of our trajectories as people. Like, you can't, there's minimal, not as many jobs anymore that you can get without an actual education. Like, then I understand why people have that mindset. But that goes back to the point that he made in the article about this self-fulfilling prophecy, in that people are leaving these places and taking their money from these schools, excuse me, I'm gonna be specific,
right,
because of what they think about the quality of education, right?
Exactly.
And then when they leave, the school may not have been that bad, right? Or it might have been on the up and up, but because you left, you've now taken your money and you've taken your resources. And now that you're at your suburban school, because you're like, oh, they're performing higher over there. Now teachers and all stakeholders of urban schools have to do more with less because you took your resources, you took your money. So it's kind of I'm conflicted.
Right.
Because I want people to do what's right for the children.
Right.
But I'm also like, that's not what's right for us as a whole.
And I completely agree with you on that. And I think that going back to what you were saying, I think that even diving deeper, I think that we fail to realize that the data can show a lot and it can show what's not enough. And I think that schools oftentimes spin data to purport what they want us to believe as opposed to what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And like, if you actually go into a school, and I think that this is something that I've been a very big advocate for, is I will... And I'm not a parent yet, but prayerfully one day I will be a parent. But like the day that I am a parent, I want to be in that school. I want to interview these teachers.
Yes,
I want
to
talk to the administration. I want to know what's happening in the school so that I know what my child is reaping from this type of environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the data and the statistics, home price data from Redfin and school quality data, whatever that even means, school quality data from based off of test scores, that doesn't mean anything. Because if that teacher, or not even the teacher, actually, if that school is not actually teaching their students how to take tests, if that school is not teaching their students how to study, if that school is not teaching their students test-based skills, like there's just so many things in which you can talk about. In which you have to make sure that students know before they even get to the test. And those two factors aren't enough to say that, oh, okay, like, I'm going to move to this area in this country, in this city, to make sure that my kids are going to be destined for success.
Yeah.
And so that, like, I can't get with that. That I really struggle with that whole idea.
Mm-hmm. I see. Take a deep breath.
Yes.
I'm gonna get more.
I was bad.
The fire, the bigger.
All right.
That kind of goes back to another like piece of data that he stated in the article, that like families and neighborhoods, so your environmental factors account for 60% of the variance in student test scores in urban and suburban settings, while teachers only account for 10% of the variance in test scores between urban and suburban settings.
Right.
I was kind of conflicted with that piece of data because I have read other data in other places that says that teacher effectiveness is one of the largest contributing factors to student academic success.
Mm-hmm.
So those two pieces don't quite go together.
Right.
But I liked it because this is the first time that that's people are really saying, give them data about people's environment, students' environment.
Exactly.
And then he goes on to talk about, and I think like, you know, a lot of people think about this, but most people may not know that, you know, when you have more money, like when you're in the suburban areas.
You have more what?
Money.
Okay.
When you're in those suburban areas, about 2/3 of the population of suburban schools is white.
Hmm.
Those people are more likely to have had a college education or some type of education. And so in those households, there's more conversations, there's more words that are being thrown around. So by the time they get to pre-K or kindergarten, wherever the students actually start, they have this foundation of literacy and numeracy and math literacy. So they're already like, that's like where the gap starts, because the students that are in these urban settings, these urban environments, do not have the same access to this foundation of knowledge. What point was I trying to make there? Sometimes I'll be going on.
I mean, I think, but like even going to that point, I just found this little quote from what his article stated. It says, urban schools also serve an increasing majority of young people from persistently disadvantaged households. Such students are likely to be surrounded by adults with low levels of educational attainment and limited professional prospects, a social context that can have a powerful impact on how students approach school and see their future.
Yeah.
And that is something that we know to be true. Yeah. Like at the end of the day, if you have somebody that went to college, if you have somebody that even knows about the college landscape, they are inherently more likely to read books to you as a child. They are inherently more likely to give you structure when you are during your upbringing.
Yep.
And like, if that does not happen, a child then shows up to pre-K 3, pre-K 4, which is generally where a kid starts to go to school. They show up to there and they're just like, oh, okay, like, what's up? Like, I'm here, I'm ready to go to school, but not really prepared for what is to come. And that's structure. That's an environment.
Let me pop in real fast.
Please.
Let me clarify what pre-K 3 and pre-K 4 mean. Because, we both went to school in California. We didn't really have pre-K 3, pre-K 4. Mm-mm. So there was a large movement for early learning and developing early learning programs as a means to, like, close the gap between Black and white, the racial gap, and also close the gap between how America performs in comparison to, you know, all these international countries. Mm-hmm. Pre-K 3 is like preschool for 3-year-olds. Pre-K 4 is preschool for 4-year-olds. So there are buildings, there are schools that have classes of 3-year-olds and then classes of 4-year-olds. So these are the 2 years prior to kindergarten. So if you hear us say pre-K 3, pre-K 4, know that that's what we're talking about. Like, there are preschools still, but now they're kind of like more specific and more defined and sometimes already built into the elementary school. That might be something that's new to some people.
Absolutely. And just to absolutely. And I think that just to stamp that, I think that studies have shown that students are a lot more likely to perform at higher rates in regards to like reading, mathematics, if they go and attend these pre-K 3 and pre-K 4 schools.
Yes.
But back to your point that you were saying earlier about like this whole notion that urban schools are serving a majority of students from a persistently disadvantaged household. Mm-hmm. I think that you were trying to like figure out like where.
How they connected.
Right. Do you remember? If not, we can go on to the next point too.
No, I really just wanted to make that statement in regards to the numbers and talking about this movement in parents really like taking their kids out of these urban education settings and talking about, oh, I got it.
Yes.
Parents taking their kids out of urban education settings and trying to get them into suburban education settings due to the test scores. Right. Hmm. And me and Jahad both believe, and I know a bunch of true educators that believe that a child is more than their test scores and more than just clear academic growth. Like, you know, we're trying to build students with character. We're trying to create innovators, create students that are creative. And so we then miss the conversation. Parents that are just looking at the data are missing the conversations about like, what type of relationships is the child having with the teachers? Do they feel safe at the school, especially in the climate that we're in? But people are buying houses based off of test scores. Mm. But we're not thinking about the broader things. That was my final point.
and I love that though, because I think that that's something that we truly don't get into. I think that, and it's kind of this idea that we just believe in what is tradition. And what is tradition is to know how much you're paying for your home. What is tradition is to know what students are scoring on these tests. Mm-hmm. But what is not tradition is to know what these teachers are teaching in the school, or not even the teachers, just more so like what the districts are requiring for these teachers to teach in the schools.
Yes.
And I think that that's what we really need to be talking about, because at the end of the day, if we aren't going to be able to be as receptive to this type of content. And like, we just don't, we inherently don't know what mm-hmm. all of this is, then mm-hmm. we're not going to be set up for the best. We're not going to be set up for success.
We're not.
And so I think that that's what we need to talk about. That's what we need to discuss, because mm-hmm. it's a lot easier for us as Black people, as folks of color, to learn about ourselves. But that's not what is often given. And more importantly, we're not taught in those types of settings.
No.
And that's what I think that we need to make sure that our kids are learning in those types of environments, and make sure that Black students are learning in that type of call and response like we were doing at the beginning, you know? Mm-hmm. But if that's not happening, then why do we expect for us to be performing off the charts on these test scores? Why do we expect right. for these home buyer evaluations to be significantly higher than other areas? Mm-hmm. But I think that also, so there is this point, it says, demographically, integrated schools have been shown to foster a culture of success that can change a child's sense of academic self-efficacy and plans for the future. And I think that you...
Speak on your point.
I think that this is where the article took a turn for me, because I was feeling it.
Yeah.
And then I was just like, let's talk about that, because demographically, me personally, I don't know if integration was the best thing for Black people. I honestly feel as if folks of color, we could have done a much better job had we been had we remained segregated.
Yeah.
Because of the fact of call and response, because of the fact that we were doing things that are a lot more tactile. We were tactile learners. I mean, we were doing things that were a lot more hands-on. We were doing things mm-hmm. in which we're engaging with our teachers. And that's not the same type of teaching, and that's not the same type of learning that happens in the majority of education spaces yeah. today. So this is where that article shifts for me. And that's what I found to be very troubling.
Yeah, because that line does somewhat imply that non-white students, and we talk a lot about Black students because that's what we have the most experience with, but like non-white students will be, well, the data shows that non-white students are better off with integration, unfortunately. But you need the context to know that that's because there's like, resources, and they're sharing critical thinking skills because they're coming from different cultures, different backgrounds, as opposed to like just these disadvantaged areas. Yeah, that is really unfortunate. But then in my head, I'm like, this is why we need more Black educators. And when I say Black educators, I mean educators that are Black. Mm. And there's like a difference between, for me, a teacher and an educator. A teacher is somebody who comes in and thinks they can teach content, and an educator is somebody who is like trying to educate the whole child. And a part of me really believes that like you're somewhat born an educator, or like you have like a different passion behind it. But we need more people like that, that are like right. Black and plan to stay in education, even if you don't plan to stay in the classroom, like you plan to stay in education, not you, oh, I want to give back to my community, so I taught for 2 to 3 years. Like, we just need more Black organizations as well, because there was a statement in there that said that integrated schools are usually ran better than segregated schools. Mm-hmm. And it's true.
It is.
It's true. I've only worked yeah. in two public charter schools here in DC, but the first one, well, I wouldn't say that the population was integrated, not the student population.
Right.
But I would say there were a majority of non-whites that ran the school. And it was like very, very organized. And now I work at a school and I love my coworkers as people, but we're not the most organized and we're not the most communicative. And we're teaching the same student population, but you can see how lack of organization in like these segregated places does not always allow for positive outcomes for our non-white students.
Absolutely. And just to stamp like what Lindsay was saying, Ms. Black, was the fact that the quote is, but it's also a result of the fact that integrated schools end up being organized and operated differently than segregated ones, focus less on compliance and discipline. And that is something that is so important that we have to realize, and we need, like, us as a people have to focus on. We cannot continue to police Black and brown students. Like, other folks in other school districts, they don't focus on that. They focus on how you can meet your student where they are at. And that is what is not being taken into account consistently. And that's what we need to focus on. How can we as educators meet our students where they are at? Because that is what in turn will make sure that our students are achieving what they need to achieve as far as the learning, the skills and the need, as well as so much further on in life. Mm-hmm. And that's what we don't, that's what we fail to discuss. That's the conversation that we don't have enough. And I think that that's what is extremely important. So thank you for bringing that up, because I feel like that was extremely important.
Yeah. See, the thing is, like, you know, I believe in Black people, but we can also just go beyond race and this like racial gap right now. The data shows that we could take the top 10%. And I think I'm talking primarily about the math data, because I'm a math educator, so I'm looking at that stuff all the time.
Right.
But the data shows that even our top 10% in America, right, it's probably going to be whites, okay? Our top 10% in America is still performing almost exponentially lower than the bottom 10% in Sweden.
Right.
Like, so we could talk about this, like, racial gap, and I think, like, people like to talk about the racial gap in America because – you know, we have a class system, and
talk about it.
it allows a group to be superior and allows another group to be inferior. But if we really want to get down to the nitty gritty, we're all inferior to our competitors internationally.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this stuff that we're saying, although we talk about like Black people and non-white people in comparison to white people and the resources and the things that they're gifted, just, you know, foundationally based on white supremacy and all.
Right.
But we can really talk about all of us. But we also know that if you help the most oppressed people, like all of those things, a few systems that was set in place will help everybody, or everybody can benefit from that.
Exactly.
So... In short,
we cracked the code. We figured it all out.
And I am an urban educator.
Absolutely. You are.
Yes, by all definitions and means.
Yes. And, you know, I think that just to summarize, or not even summarize his article, but to look at like one of his closing points, it states that acting on perception that schools are far more unequal than they really are. Many well-intended parents play a crucial role in turning perception into reality. Completely agree with that. Agree with that. But I think that to that point, like I said, just as if we're meeting the student where they're at, I do the same thing for the parent. And
woo!
I feel like it's a wraparound model that schools don't have in place.
Yeah,
and we need to do a better job of holding the schools accountable and not educators, the school as a whole, accountable for meeting the parent, meeting the student, meeting the community where they're at. And I think that there are a lot of ways in which schools are just coming into the community and just expecting, oh, okay, like we're teaching the kids.
Yep.
So like everything's just going to fall into place. That's not how it works.
No.
And until we break that down, we're not going to be able to actually progress and get anywhere. So
it could all be so simple.
Yeah.
Love it. Yeah, please.
No, but please, you want to?
Yeah, let's just close this out.
Yes.
Essentially, I hope that people have a better understanding of the denotation of urban education and the connotation of urban education based on our opinion and our responses to this article, which will be linked in the episode description. But I also hope that people are forming their own perceptions on urban education, or shifting and changing their perceptions on urban education.
Absolutely. And last but most importantly, we would love to know what y'all think about all of this. Like, feel free to comment on our social media, to send us an email.
Send a text, friends. Oh,
that's
friends that have the number, send a text.
Absolutely. Do what you need to do. We would love to know what you think. And yeah. Let's continue to have this conversation about all of this.
Fight the good fight.
Absolutely. The call to action is our chance to let you know how you can help. It takes a village in order for all of us to create meaningful change. This week's call to action is, if you know somebody, tell somebody about the Reformist Pipeline. our podcast. This is the only way we will create reform by spreading the word so everyone can be informed.
And with that, you can catch the Reformist Pipeline, or TRP, every other Monday on your preferred platform. And we would just like to say,
peace and love, y'all.
Peace and love. Hootie hoo.
Hey.